Well, 2012, of course, is the Australian Year of the Farmer. And we know there are lots of farmers out there working pretty hard all over Australia. But what about the ladies of the land? Well, believe it or not, there are some extraordinary women who are out there running properties all over this country. And Liz Howful, who is a journalist, she's an award-winning journalist, in fact, she's also a PR lady. Now she's working full-time. She won a Churchill Fellowship. And she has put together this extraordinary book about the fascinating stories of eight remarkable women who are indeed making their living on the land and making a wonderful contribution to agriculture in this country. And Liz has joined us on the line from her home in the Adelaide Hills this morning. Hi, Liz, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Well, what a great book. What inspired it? Was it the fact that it was the year of the farmer?
No, do you know, I didn't even really know that that was coming up when I started work on the book. I actually had one of those miraculous situations where, for any author, where a publisher contacted me. And I was contacted by a publisher from Allen and Unwin, who was looking for someone to help tell the stories of rural Australia from a woman's perspective. And we talked around a few ideas, and I was very keen to write about women who were running their own farms, because I already knew a couple of women who I thought had remarkable stories, and I'd been looking for an excuse to write about them, so this was the chance.
Well, now, did you think when you started on this project that you would have so many to choose from?
No, I didn't. I mean, I knew there were quite a few out there. I guess it's widely accepted these days there are a lot of women who are farmers, but most people assume those women are doing it in conjunction with husbands, fathers, brothers, as opposed to either owning the farm outright themselves or being the person responsible for managing it and, you know, making the big decisions. Mm. I ended up very quickly with way more options than I needed of people to write about, and I'm sure I'm going to learn about many more now that the book is coming out.
Absolutely. So how did you go about selecting the ones, the eight ladies you finally decided on?
For me, I thought it was really important that the book had some balance and covered as much of Australia as possible. I was looking for a lot of diversity in the kinds of farms, and also, I guess, they had to have a very strong personal story to tell, as well as a strong story about the farm they were running. They had to be good farmers. And because I come from, you know, I grew up on a small dairy farm in a place called Mallel, way over on the southern tip of South Australia, and it's not the outback. And there's a lot of books been written about the outback, but I was quite keen that I should include farms that came from the more settled parts of rural Australia, which, after all, constitute where most regional Australians live, and I think are quite often, too often, overlooked.
Hmm. So having had that background, did that help you to persuade these ladies to actually talk to you?
I suspect it did, because I think for them they probably felt more comfortable talking to someone who they knew had grown up on a farm and knew what farm life and living in a regional area was all about. So I'm sure that did help, yes.
Great stuff. All right, let's take a look at the very first pen portrait that you wrote about a lady who lives in our listing area, in fact, out at Tarrant Rock at Lake Grace, this extraordinary Mary Naisbitt.
Yes. Mary's story, I mean, I keep using this, that none of these women think of themselves as extraordinary.
No, well, I bet they don't.
They think of themselves as, you know, quite, well, not, you know, they've just done what they've had to do. Mary grew up in a little place called Meriden, and then when she was a young girl, the family moved to Midland. I guess it's almost suburban Perth.
Well, though. It is, yes, 5 minutes from me. It is, just down the hill, yes.
And she had an office job, a very good one, working in Perth when she met Joe, a farmer from near Lake Grace. So essentially she didn't come from a farming background, but they had four children, and the youngest, Kevin, was only a baby. The oldest was about six when Joe dropped dead one afternoon on the tennis court playing tennis at Tarrant Rock, and left Mary with four young children and a farm of about 3,000 acres that she had to try and work out what to do with.
Now, many women would have just simply walked away, sold the place and gone and done something else, but not this one. She decided she wasn't going anywhere.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I'm sure, and so is Mary, that most people expected that the sensible thing for her to do would have been to sell the farm and take the kids and move back to Midland and, you know, back to where her parents lived. And but she decided that she loved the farm and that she wanted to give her children the chance to grow up on a farm, and that if they chose to, when they were, you know, older, if they wanted to be farmers, to give them that opportunity. She had no expectations that that would happen, but she wanted to have, you know, create those options for them.
And of course, the sensible thing she did was to organise share farmers, and that was, and that's what helped her through.
It is. I mean, she got some really good advice early on. I think a neighbour it was that sort of suggested to her, why didn't she talk to a farm consultant? Now, in those days, using farm consultants to provide advice was not all that common. A few farmers were doing it, but this person suggested to her that the farm advisor might have some suggestions. And the advisor said to her, keep it simple, Mary. Let's sort of keep it as simple as we can. Let's get someone else to do the cropping, and you can focus on the sheep. And you know, there were good reasons for that, because Mary, the farm itself, that she didn't have access to a lot of its own equipment. Her husband Joe had used that in conjunction with other members of his family, and it was needed on other properties. So she had to sort of try and find a way of doing it without having to make that sort of huge investment, not just in gaining knowledge, but in the hours involved. And the farm advisor sort of made that suggestion, which worked out very well for her indeed.
And then ultimately, of course, her son, Kevin, who went off to ag school, then went off overseas, came back and did come back to the farm.
Yes, he made that decision too. As I said, there was no pressure on him to do that, and he had some options, but he decided it was something he really wanted to do. So he's now pretty well running the farm. Mary is out there frequently lending a hand. I think he describes her as his best sort of farmhand. Mary is his best farmhand, and Mary is sort of spending more of her time these days doing a lot of community work in Lake Grace. But yeah, so that was one of the outcomes, I guess, of that.
Indeed, and of course, she decided she'd stand for the council. Didn't think she'd ever get a hope in hell, and she got elected.
I think Mary's community is really important to her. It's one of the things that came through to me very strongly. And another one of the reasons why I was drawn to Mary's story is because, to me, it reflects the hardiness of her whole community. The year I came to see Mary last year when I was researching the story was also the centenary year of Lake Grace. And Lake Grace, you know, and the farming area around it have been through some really tough times over the years. And when I was there, they were still in drought.
Yeah.
Hopeful of a good break to the season, as you know they are every year, but it had been a really tough few years, and I was drawn to the story of Mary not just because of her resilience, but the resilience shown by the entire community in which she lives.
Indeed, so, and it's a pretty vibrant little community. I mean, they're out in the back blocks at Lake Grace. You know, I mean, the nearest towns are 130 km away or whatever, and they're very resilient out that neck of the woods.
Yeah, they are, and they've been very inventive as a community in terms of recreating their future and you know, trying to establish themselves with the tourist sort of industry and
yeah.
Some tourism opportunities, and they've got some wonderful things there, like the Mission Hospital Museum, and it's a great place to sort of stop. The spectacular salt lakes themselves of Lake Grace, and in the wildflower season, the wildflowers, and they've done a, you know, they've got a brilliant sort of community-run tourism office there that draws a lot of people, and you know, Mary's been involved with that over the years, and so is her daughter Trish, and I just thought it was a lovely example of a community reinventing itself to survive in, you know, different times.
Indeed. I love the story about her actually sitting on the veranda and hearing a shuffling. Very uncanny, that.
It was quite a poignant moment, I think, sort of towards the end of the few days I spent over there with Mary. And she just talked about the fact that there were times, you know, when she saw Kevin as he got older, and hearing sort of the steps on the veranda, that she had this kind of sense that it was Joe, and she can't put down what the footsteps in had this feeling of Joe was like. There's just something about it that reminded her very much of her husband, and Kevin definitely looks a lot like his dad, so
yeah. What an extraordinary story. This lady who simply could have walked away but chose not to, and has carved out a real niche for herself and her younger son now in Lake Grace.
Yeah, she has. And she talks a lot about how that was made possible by the help and support of friends and neighbours. You know, her one of her best friends, Joan, who would come by, you know, with food prepared in the evenings when she'd had a long day on the farm, and help look after the kids, and various other neighbours that helped take the wool into the, you know, into town, and you know, showed her how to weld, because she taught us, you know, she taught herself how to do the welding.
Wow.
You know, there were all these lovely sort of examples of the community really stepping up to, you know, to help her out when she needed it.
Indeed, so it's a wonderful portrait of an extraordinary lady, and really, really very tough, and a tough negotiator too, by the sound of it. She didn't stand any nonsense from anybody.
No, she, you know, by all accounts, she knew a fair price, and she knew how to negotiate with various agents and retailers and take the blokes on at clearing sales and auctions when she needed to.
Yeah.
Very good business brain there too, I think.
Oh, indeed so. Wonderful piece of journalism there. Now, I thought I might talk about one of your fellow South Australians, Catherine Bird, who's at Wiluka. What an extraordinary story. This girl is very lucky to be alive, one has to say.
Yes, she is. Another tough cookie.
Oh, very much so. Oh, tough in terms of, you know, the upbringing she had, and then what happened afterwards.
Life's thrown a lot of things at Catherine, and she's still there smiling. So, Catherine grew up a station brat, that's how she describes herself. She came off a property called Indiana, a big station sort of out, way out east of Alice Springs on the edge of the Simpson Desert. And it was, you know, alone. I mean, she had other siblings that she grew up with, but it was a pretty isolated existence. She might get into Alice once or twice a year if she was lucky, and essentially it was just people on the station that she saw and the mail plane coming in. She ended up marrying and sort of spending quite a few years in Alice Springs. She had some quite traumatic experiences getting to the whole, used to the whole idea of boarding school, which was not her favourite thing at all.
No.
The whole idea of being away from off the station and away from home. You know, her first marriage didn't go well at all. There was some, you know, real issues there that she had to deal with in terms of... that, you know, I guess you would call it not, there was no sort of physical abuse, but there was certainly sort of, you know, issues that she had to deal with in her relationship. And she ended up coming down to a small farm in a much different part of the world, near Keith, in South Australia. She was the mother of two young children when she went out into the paddock one day to do some fencing. And she had all the safety gear on. She had her long hair back in a ponytail under a cap. But there was a pretty fierce wind, and she was sort of standing near an auger when the wind ripped her cap off and blew the end of her ponytail into the blades of the auger. And effectively, in the next minute or so, she was virtually scalped.
Mm-hmm.
Her scalp was left hanging on by about a centimetre of skin behind one ear.
Dear.
Yes. Catherine is so matter-of-fact when she talks about this.
Mm.
She's really come to terms with the accident and what happened afterwards. I think she's just amazing, the way that she talks about it. And she has some very clear memories of what she describes as a near-death experience of hearing her father's voice. Her father had died a little while before, and of what she went through. Almost in slow motion, she paints this picture of every second of what happened, as her hair was, you know, trapped in the auger until her sister managed to switch the auger off and then extract her from it. And fortunately for Catherine, she was only about 15 minutes drive from a hospital with an emergency department. From there, you know, that hospital was the last hospital on the highway that was within flying distance of the intensive care emergency team from Adelaide, who flew a helicopter in and got her back to Adelaide. And 14 hours of surgery later, and that was just her first of 10 surgeries, she was on the road to recovery.
What an extraordinary... I mean, she really is. When you think she was in hospital for 6 weeks and, look, she had different types of staph infections as well as what to get in hospitals these days. And, you know, at the end of the day, to come out of that... I mean, and yet psychologically, she seems to be pretty balanced about the whole thing.
She is, and she's incredibly focused on using her experiences to help other people. You know, for Catherine, these things have all happened for a reason, and if she can help other people, then that's what she wants to do. And, you know, in the first few years after her accident, she did quite a lot of speaking at field days and things about farm safety, which was the first sort of way she started trying to put her experience to good use. And she's since done a little more sort of broader things, talking to people about, I guess, almost motivational, talks to other women and to people about what her experience is. And, and she's very focused on her health and nutrition and eating well and looking after her body, because that played a big part in her recovery. Was just really focused on, you know, fresh fruit and vegetables and vitamins and minerals and all those things that helped her gain her strength. So she's very much an ambassador for those kind of things now.
Yes, I did spy